you asked if we wanted anything in particular. I thought we were interested that compassion, as you seem to be so compassionate. And you can talk a little bit about compassion, I gather. So
I think
we look
so.
Forward to it.
Great. Thank you. Well, it's lovely to be here. And suddenly the room got filled. I don't know. We got here, there were only a couple of people, but suddenly you've all appeared. And also we have quite a few people online. So about 17 people. Lovely to see the people online as well. So thank you, Singh. And I was invited to Kettering now for the third time, you say?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was two or three times. And I really like coming here. One of the reasons I like to come is because you do refer to yourselves as Buddhists.
We do what?
Refer to yourselves as Buddhists.
Yes.
Which not many groups do these days. Most groups are more like insight groups or meditation groups, but sometimes they might be missing the full picture.
Oh, I see.
And there's something that about the Buddha's teachings that inspires devotion, it inspires confidence and trust.
We bill ourselves as Buddhist and meditation.
Very good, because practicing Buddhists meditate, isn't it?
Yeah.
And practicing Buddhists practice compassion, I hope, because that's in a way one of the goals, one of the motivations, but also the goals of our practice, and in a way a manifestation and an expression of the wisdom that we come to understand through direct experience of this body and mind that we tend to call ourselves. So today I wanted to give a talk something like around the theme of compassion and sadness, and I wasn't quite sure what to call it. I wanted to talk about the difference between the two, but then I thought, you know what, they're included in each other actually, and there's a place that they meet, there's a place that they can come together, and I wanted to talk about that as well, because on the Buddhist path, it's important that we don't bypass any experience, that we include everything in our experience. We allow our entire experience, the pleasant and the unpleasant, the wanted and the unwanted, the disagreeable as well as the agreeable, and we allow all of that onto the path. We make it available to wisdom. So, and compassion is one of the ways to help us do that. So I thought we may start with a meditation, because I believe that's what you're also very keen on doing, and just to arrive and to ground ourselves and maybe to start bringing in this theme of compassion by first of all contacting our body and mind and giving ourselves some time and some space. And after that we'll have a Dhamma talk, and hopefully at the end there'll be time for some question and answers. And should we include the questions from the Zoom people, depending how much time and space we have? Maybe prioritize people here, because it is quite something to make the trip here. So I want to make sure people here are able to ask or discuss anything they feel they wish. But if there's time, we'll come to the Zoom as well. Okay, so for everybody, whether you're online or in person, try and find a very comfortable position, which can be adjusted for your body. Sometimes we don't know what our body needs until we close our eyes. And it's only then that we realize we've been rather hasty in how we settle ourselves down. So please make any adjustments that will bring more comfort and ease for your body. Don't have to sit in a formal meditation posture. There's a beautiful stone carving of the Buddha in one of the caves, I think at Ellora or Ajanta caves in India, of the future Buddha sitting on a seat. So, I don't know, are you future Buddhas? There's a lot of future Buddhas in this room. And if you are comfortable to do so, you can close your eyes. And with our eyes closed, we can start to sense into our bodies. perhaps regarding our bodies as a very dear friend. Clearing your throat if you need to. Stretching if you need to. Stretching if you feel a little bit tense or tight. Finding a point of balance and a sense of being grounded. As well as alert. And it's an alertness that is soft, that is receptive, not that is forced. But an attitude of openness and curiosity. Grounded on the floor or on your chair. Feeling your feet on the ground. Maybe your lower legs, buttocks, on the cushion if you're sitting on the floor. Feeling held. Moving up your spine, noticing how your spine also holds you, gives you stability and support. So that all the muscles in your legs, in your back, right up to your shoulders and through your arms can hang loose, can just yield to the gravity and relax. Maybe encouraging this relaxation with a few slightly deeper breaths. And inviting yourself to relax more fully on the out-breath. Allowing the muscles in the jaw, the cheeks, the eyes, the brow. Allowing them to relax, the tension to drain away on the out-breath. Releasing any holding. No one's looking at you right now. So you can let your face be at ease. Remove the social mask. Even allowing your scalp to relax. And as you do this, you will already be becoming more receptive to the feelings in your body. Physical, bodily sensations that are happening right now in this present moment. The direct experience of this moment. Establishing your mindfulness in a grounded and embodied way, aware of any feelings in your body from head to toe. And letting them be. Just being present. Feeling that support of the ground. And relaxing. As you simply receive whatever sensations are arising for you right now. And now we're going to add kindness to the way that we're aware, to develop a healthy relationship of compassion, of care towards our experience, looking at our experience, if you like, through the eyes of a loving mother or a compassionate Buddha. Maybe a Kuan Yin or the Dalai Lama, someone you consider compassionate and wise. Eyes of benevolence without judgment. With warmth and care. Notice if and how those sensations change. When you regard them with compassion, with tender care. How does compassion feel? How does it feel in your body? What is its effect on your emotional world? You might imagine this beautiful, compassionate awareness, like a color that's soaking through your body and mind, suffusing every cell, every part of your emotional world, with warmth, with healing, with care. And if you wish to continue in this way, please do. Using whatever imagery, whatever color, sense of a being, what compassion means to you, to build compassion. Or if you wish, you can use language, use words, phrases of compassionate care towards yourself. You can find your own phrases if you wish, or share the ones I've been using today. So, keeping your awareness grounded in the body, perhaps around the heart area, if that's comfortable for you. Listen to the words and feel into the meaning between each phrase. May I hold this suffering gently. May I shower myself with care. May I be free from pain and fear. May I be fully at ease. May I hold this suffering gently. May I shower myself with care. May I be free from pain and fear. May I be fully at ease. So if you'd like to continue with these phrases or your own phrases that resonate for you, repeat them clearly, slowly, rhythmically, connecting to the meaning of each phrase as though you really are showering yourself with blessings. And after you recite mentally in your own mind each phrase, just pause to allow the heart to open towards the meaning of those blessings, towards the emotional experience of compassion that's growing in your heart. Keeping it really simple if you wish, maybe just one or two phrases is enough. Relaxing as you receive your own compassion. focusing on the freedom from suffering, not the suffering itself. Acknowledging that we all have some sadness, some pain in our heart, giving it space, but then allowing compassion to heal. Staying connected to your own body and mind. Allow your heart to open to the beings around you, the ones right here in the Quaker meeting house, the ones in your home or in your town. Recognizing that all beings, wherever they are, have some sadness, have some grief, some pain in their lives. Many beings are living in fear. Allow your heart to be touched. To be moved and affected. And then allow that compassion to flow. Perhaps again, visualizing compassion as a beautiful color that represents warmth, care, healing to you, or as an energy, softness, warmth, comfort. Okay. and allow it to spread in every direction, as far as it will. May all beings be free, free from pain and fear. May all beings be safe and at ease. Sending compassion to the people or the places that may need it the most. Allowing your heart to respond. May all beings, those who are virtuous, those who are cruel, may all beings be free from pain and fear. May all beings be free from harm and from harming. Free from all cruelty and ill will. May all beings be safe and at ease. All beings, including animals, birds, fish, and the tiniest of insects. All beings who may be in the hell realms or heavenly realms, invisible beings, beings we may not even believe exist. Wherever there is life, may all beings be free. May all beings be safe and at ease. Imagine that freedom from suffering, freedom from cruelty. Imagine all beings living in peace. And now we're going to come back to ourselves, to our bodies, to our emotional world. Notice how it feels in your heart right now. And see if someone comes to mind, someone dear to you, A friend, a partner, maybe someone who's passed away recently. Or someone who's going through some challenge. Physical pain or emotional difficulty. Bring them to mind as though they were in front of you and shower them with compassion. Drenching every part of them. From the top of their head to the tips of their toes. Maybe it's a pet. Soothing them. With compassionate, tender care. Using any words that come from your heart. As though you were speaking from your heart to theirs, looking into their eyes. Give them all the compassion you've got, unreservedly, unconditionally. Without expectation or demand. Metta karuna mudita upekkha. Metta karuna mudita upekkha. Metta karuna mudita upekkha. You can chant along if you wish. Metta karuna mudita upekkha. 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 So keep your eyes closed a moment longer. And just feel the soothing energy we've just shared. Bringing us together. Perhaps softening, helping to soften our pain, our loneliness, our sense of despair. Could you hear different voices from the Zoom group? Could you hear? There's a nice little hum over here. You couldn't hear that? That's a shame. It's a very nice hum. Voices together. My throat was a bit, otherwise I'd have harmonized. But there's a nice little chant you can do. You know that chanting actually stimulates the vagus nerve, and the vagus nerve stimulates the kind of rest and restore, rest and, what do they call it, rest and
digest.
That's very important if you're not a monastic, because you might have had dinner. But for me, that's not so important right now. Yes, rest and digest, the soothing centers of the brain, which are responsible for relaxation and ease and a sense of safety. Because if you think about it, if you're being attacked or pursued or even bullied, but you're singing, you're chanting, you're not really going to feel scared. In fact, when you're chanting or singing or laughing, you can't really have fear simultaneously. So it's a little method you can use if you have a lot of anxiety or if you're feeling down or disconnected. It's a very nice way to bring some soothing to the nervous system. So today, as I said, we're going to talk about where compassion or where sadness meets compassion. And I know that there's at least a few people in the Zoom room who are keen on this subject because a lot of us have sadness and even despair about the state of the world, if not the state of the world, the state of our own bodies, the state of our maybe relationships, or just being a human being and all that includes and involves and the challenges we face in day-to-day life. And it doesn't really help when we hear on the news about all the terrible, cruel ways that human beings behave towards one another as though it's almost legitimate and becomes increasingly emboldened sometimes on certain social media channels, even in the mainstream news. We don't seem to be able to call out cruelty for what it is sometimes, and yet it hurts. It really hurts our heart. So what do we do with this? How do we even begin to respond? You know, sometimes it can feel overwhelming. We can feel completely helpless in the face of what seems to be so much hostility and cruelty in life. And of course, the Buddha's teaching was all around suffering, how to encounter suffering in a way that can lead to the path out. And compassion is a very key part of that. As I said in the beginning, compassion is an expression and a manifestation of the wisdom we develop on the path. If you have knowledge, you understand things intellectually, but it doesn't ensue in compassion, then what is the point of that? Maybe you feel very clever, you can preach to your friends, but it doesn't increase the sense of care that you live your life with. It doesn't really help to alleviate suffering in a profound and genuine way. And so the Buddha talked about the Four Noble Truths, about suffering and the universality of suffering, and also the cause. One of the causes is craving, of course, but another cause is ill will, is hate, is cruelty. You know, is an unwholesome response to that very same suffering. And the freedom from that suffering is to, one of the ways that we can free ourselves from that suffering is to develop a wholesome response, what the Buddha called right motivation, the second factor of the path. So the first factor is right view, which includes some understanding of the fact that we're in the realm of suffering as human beings, whether we're fortunate, we have homes, we have safety, we have enough to eat, or whether we're really unfortunate and our fortunes and misfortunes change all the time. But still, this is a universal experience that we're going to have to meet. And so when suffering is universal, the answer has to be universal, and it has to reach all beings. And so the Buddha taught compassion as one of the divine abidings. Excuse me. I think a sip of tea is in order to relieve the suffering in my throat. In this regard, the English are very wise. We know how to relieve some kinds of suffering with tea. And so the Buddha, does that sound really croaky to all of you? Sounds quite croaky to me. Oh well. Hopefully I won't lose my voice too soon. Someone drove me here. They came 2 hours to pick me up, 2 hours to bring me here. They have to drive 2 hours to take me back, 2 hours to get back here, 8 hours of driving. So please, throat, do not lose your voice. Anyway. Yeah, get me some hot water. That'd be good. So compassion is to be developed in a universal way. And the Buddha talked about it as a divine abiding, a sublime abiding that is to be extended to all the four quarters in every direction, above and below, and encompass all beings in the entire universe, whether they are like us or not, whether they vote the same way or not, whether, you know, they're Buddhist or not, whatever race, whatever gender, whatever sexual orientation, compassion is compassion. And when we develop it to that level, it goes beyond self and others. Suffering goes beyond self and others. So it's not about me and my suffering or you and your suffering, but it's about suffering as a noble truth and compassion as a universal response to that suffering. And the Buddha said when he was enlightened that he taught out of one thing and one thing only. He was enlightened. He'd relieved suffering. He'd uprooted it from his heart completely. And there was no real need for him to do anything else. And yet he was motivated to teach others out of compassion for the highest happiness and ultimate benefit of beings. So this is a beautiful motivating quality that we can all bring to the path and that should be our main motivation in practice. And that we can develop to those very exalted states, which are equivalent to the jhanas, deep states of samadhi. And as I said, it's also a manifestation of wisdom. When we uproot cruelty completely from our heart, then our wisdom is perfected. And only compassion remains. Compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. These are the four Brahma viharas. And yet I think compassion can be one of the more challenging, and for many of us, it's a little bit scary to approach. And partly this is because of our fear of being overwhelmed. We're afraid that if we open our hearts, even to our own suffering, let alone the suffering in the world, we'll be overwhelmed, we'll be driven to a sense of despair and helplessness. Yeah. We might also not know, we might not have the emotional maturity, we could say, or just cultivation of being able to handle difficult emotions in a skillful way. You know, we may have a habit of suppressing our emotions because they get in the way, right? I mean, understandable, we have to function, we have to go about our jobs, we have to, you know, be a good partner, a good friend, etc. And, you know, sometimes it's not appropriate to come to work with a tear-streamed face, you know, or to come in with anxiety. We need to stay at home. And so because we don't know how to handle these emotions, we're afraid of them and we might suppress them, or perhaps we might indulge them. You know, we might get literally overwhelmed because we don't know how to relate with compassion. Compassion sometimes, and I've spoken to a lot of people for whom this is true, sometimes people fear that it's going to make them vulnerable. It's going to make them too soft. You know, if I'm full of compassion and I care for everyone else, then maybe people will exploit me or manipulate me. Maybe, you know, I'll be taken for granted or I'll be taken advantage of. And this is also a valid concern. Of course, one of the reasons that this can happen is because we don't extend that compassion to all beings. We extend it to all other beings, but we don't include ourselves. And so we don't notice when we are actually not working for our own best interest. We forget to include ourselves fully, as we would a dear person in our lives. You know, the dear person we just practiced with could be us. You know, for many people, it is us, right? You are somebody's dearest person. You are your parents' child, whether they're alive or not, even whether they treated you well or not. They loved you enough to give you life and to try to give you the best that they could. And so you are that dear person for others. Why not for yourself? The other thing about compassion that I think sometimes people doubt is because it's so intimately connected to suffering, which makes it very profound. But because of that, people worry that it's not going to make them happy, that compassion is somehow a sorrowful state of mind. And again, we're going to touch on this during today's theme, but I wanted to talk about why this is a myth and bust some of those other myths as well, and perhaps also talk about how we can develop more resilience towards our emotional world. So how can we develop compassion in a really healthy, attuned, resourcing, and ultimately liberating way? Because it is one of the Chaito Vimuttis, the liberations of heart, the liberations of mind that the Buddha talked about, again, equivalent to the jhanas. And in particular, I wanted to bust the myth of how compassion is a happy state, not an unhappy state. Yeah, sometimes we think, oh, compassion, it's just going to make me cry. I can't bear to feel so deeply about things. But the path, and it says this somewhere in the suttas, I don't have the reference with me, but the path is a path for one who feels, not for one who doesn't feel. It's not a path for AI. It's not a path for robots, okay? They can't develop it. They don't have a body. And more importantly, they don't have a mind. But we have a body and a mind. We have rich emotional worlds, and therefore we are one who feels. And because of this, we can develop compassion. It is a cultivation. So the Brahma Viharas, the sublime abidings, are resting places of the mind, for the mind, and are blissful abidings. They're liberations here and now. And just as metta is the liberation from ill will, it's the liberation of mind, the Chaito Vimutti, from ill will. Compassion is the liberation of mind from cruelty. Cruelty also includes like apathy, indifference, disregard, contempt, of course, is a kind of cruelty, bullying. Someone was telling me a very sad story on the way here today about, do you remember these 13 or 15 Thai boys many years ago that got stranded in a cave somewhere in the north of Thailand, like a very deep cave, and they were stranded there for weeks, wasn't it, or even months?
A couple of weeks.
Yeah. And they had a really great coach in there with them who helped them to meditate and to get through this, you know, obviously psychological trauma and very real threat to life. I mean, imagine being so trapped. And I also heard of a monk, I think, who lived in Burma. He was Thai, went across to help them, and he had some kind of very strong practice and maybe some psychic powers, but he also was a great teacher for them at that time. And anyway, one of these boys, after getting out alive, got a scholarship to come over to England. Was it football?
Yes.
To be a part of a football team. And very tragically, he experienced lots of bullying to the point where he actually attempted suicide. And one of the wonderful people here was called upon to be like an end-of-life care, to offer some counselling as a Buddhist end-of-life care. What would you call your role? You're not a chaplain as such.
Chaplaincy visits.
Chaplaincy visits, yeah. But unfortunately, it was a little too late. They had to take permission from the parents or something like this. And that boy, having survived one tragedy and near-death situation, died. And this was because of cruelty. This was because of bullying, maybe naive bullying, I don't know. You know, kids can be cruel, right? Kids can be cruel. And the escape from cruelty is compassion itself. In the Buddhist path, it's called avihimsaka. It means gentleness, kindness, non-violence. And that includes to our own bodies and minds. And so a heart that is free from cruelty is obviously a much happier heart. It may be challenging to develop compassion, but it's much harder to live with a heart of hate. We often see the so-called victim as the one who is most harmed. And in a one-life perspective, perhaps that is true. And no doubt, you know, this causes unimaginable pain for those, you know, who are grieving, who lose a child, who lose a loved one. And yet that hatred in our heart is much worse. To carry that from lifetime to lifetime, to live with that much cruelty, that much separation from our basic humanity, that is the real tragedy here. And there's a simile that the Buddha uses in his teachings. It's a very extreme simile. I'm sorry if this is a little bit gruesome here, but it's the simile of the saw. And the Buddha says that people may approach you with all kinds of cruelty, all kinds of cruel and bullying words. You know, they might not be with metta. They might not be words of love and kindness. They might be words of hate. But even if they were attacked, if bandits were to attack you with a two-handled saw and actually sever your limbs, one who gave rise to a mind of hate, one who harbored thoughts of revenge, thoughts of cruelty, would not be following my teachings. Why is that? Because cruelty hurts even more. Cruelty and hatred harms and damages our mind. And it blocks the path to liberation. So the practice of the Brahmaviharas frees us from that. It frees us from all these unwholesome roots, and it fills us up with compassion even towards the perpetrators, so that resentment ultimately no longer arises. There was a lovely story in the Tibetan tradition. I think there's an autobiography about it, and it, I think, was the doctor of the Dalai Lama, was it, who was put in prison. But there's been more than one case, because I also read about a nun who this was true for as well. And they were tortured by the Chinese when they were in prison. And when they were released, like 10 or 15 years later, they were asked, you know, how did you survive? How did you possibly survive that? Because you don't seem to be full of anger. You don't seem to be resentful. And the person said, I made sure I protected my mind, because the one thing that was most scary to me, more than the torture, was developing resentment. Then this person knew that this person, I think, was a doctor, but there was also a story of a nun who did the same, praying intensively for the perpetrators and not giving in to ill will, because they knew that if they did that, that would be the failure, that would be the tragedy. So these are the kind of, right, I don't expect us all to be in these situations. And the Buddha never said, put yourself in these situations. I want to be clear, right? We do everything we can out of compassion to free ourselves from difficult, harmful situations and to help others too. Compassion is action. It starts with an intention, then it manifests and can be practiced as right thought. Yeah, this is what we were doing in the meditation. We were trying to generate thoughts of compassion, because the mind is often very easily conditioned by the thinking process. And if we put a certain train of thought in the mind, it inclines the mind towards the experience. It points the mind in the direction of the meaning of those words. And the Buddha also said that when we have a thought of compassion, right there, it's not possible. Right there, we substitute a thought of cruelty. It's not possible to have a thought of cruelty or ill will at the same time as a thought of compassion. So even if all you ever did was walk around or sit and practice saying, may I be free from pain and fear, may all beings be free from suffering, may all beings be at peace, you would be practicing really, really well. You would be clearing your mind of wrong thought, the thoughts that may then lead to actions that are cruel, that are unkind. But for it to really be compassion, it needs to manifest as action. It's fairly easy to sit alone in your comfortable place, in your comfortable home. You don't have to see anyone. You can imagine all those people outside that don't trigger you because they're not there. And you can feel that you're full of compassion. But then what happens when you meet, I don't know, even your own spouse or somebody who irritates you? Oh, for goodness sake, can't they just get out of my way? Whoops, that wasn't a thought of compassion. So it's easy to have conceptual ideas of compassion, but it needs to manifest in your speech when you meet people face to face and then later. And this means an ability to engage with what's difficult, to engage with tragedy, to engage with trauma. This might mean sitting with people who are suffering from anxiety or suffering grief, you know, as a Buddhist chaplain would have to do, sitting with people who are actually dying and who may be experiencing visceral fear, and to be able to hold space for those people. So this involves some skillful ways of being attuned to our feelings and giving them space, being able to hold space for our own emotions that arise when we're faced with the suffering in the world, our own suffering, but also the suffering of others. And sometimes it's not that we have to be smart, Alex, and have all the right things to say. I remember the first time a friend of mine lost someone very close, and I hadn't really met anyone that had even lost someone, never mind lost someone myself at that point. This is many years ago when I was young. And she lost basically the closest person to her, and I just honestly didn't know what to say. So I said, I'm so sorry, I don't know what to say. And it took a bit of vulnerability, because we want to feel we do know what to say. But she said that was just so healing and such a relief, because everyone was trying to kind of placate and say, oh, you know, don't worry, the grief will pass, or I'm terribly sorry, which is fine, you know. I'm sure there are people feel sorry when someone else's loved one dies. But just that kind of rawness of being able to hold the space without having to fix, you know, just saying, wow, that sounds really hard, I don't know what to say. This can sometimes be enough. And we have the same attitude to our emotional world. You know, we don't know how to fix it. We don't need to fix it, but just to learn to be open. So compassion then, when it needs to include the speech, the motivation, the thought, and the action, how can we define it? And one of the nicer definitions that I read recently was a profound feeling of benevolent concern that motivates us to offer help and assistance. A profound feeling of benevolent concern that motivates us to offer help and assistance in a way that alleviates pain, in a way that alleviates suffering, if at all possible. Sometimes, as I say, it's just being there for another person that can be that alleviation for them. And its goal is to care. Its goal is to care. It requires commitment. It requires courage to feel. As I said, a willingness to be raw, to be vulnerable, to be moved by the suffering in our hearts and in the world. It rescues us from feelings of helplessness and despair. Compassion is a kind of healing balm that actually gives some meaning to suffering. In my teens, I was always focused or keen to understand, actually desperate to understand, the meaning of suffering, because I could see it all around me. I could feel it in my gut, and it seemed much bigger than me. It seemed much bigger than anything I'd experienced in this lifetime. And it felt like a very heavy, kind of dark cloud. And I thought, there has to be some meaning to this. What is a compassionate response? That was my kind of inquiry that took me to India and that ultimately led me to the path. You know, how can we respond with compassion in a way that really helps? Because we can't be just here to suffer. What would be the meaning of that? And compassion is one of the meanings. You know, if there wasn't suffering, we wouldn't need to care. There wouldn't be a need to be kind to one another. But because we're fragile, because we suffer, because we hurt, because our happiness is impermanent, you know, we don't get what we want. The Four Noble Truths. Suffering is not getting what you want. Anybody ever always got what they wanted? Anyone got what they didn't want a lot more? So because of this, we have to care. Ajahn Chah had a lovely simile. He said, you know, see this cup. I hope this cup isn't cracked. But anyway, see this cup? It has a crack in it. Actually, you can't see the crack yet. And he said, but because of that, because it's fragile, we don't throw it in the bin, right? It's not cracked yet, but we know it can. We know it can shatter one day. So we care. We care for it more. And compassion bestows that healing, that warmth. And this brings me on to the kind of core of the theme, which is compassion also includes empathy. This is really important. As I said, compassion is not conceptual. It's not an idea. It's not something we preach. It's something that stems from being touched, from being affected. And that place where compassion can meet sadness, or sadness can meet compassion, is often empathy. Yeah. So empathy, if the goal of compassion is to care, we could say that the goal of empathy is to understand. So empathy is that aspect or that emotion that is able to hold space for others, that is keen to try to understand things from another person's perspective, to understand how they might be feeling, what they might be experiencing, and understand that this could be us. Right now, this is not us, it's somebody else. So how might that person feel? It's not about how we feel in response to that person. It's about how might that person feel in that situation, given their conditioning, given their life experience. What might they be going through right now? And resonating with that in an attempt to understand. And that understanding is already the beginnings of compassion. The problem here is that empathy alone is apparently, I mean, I've read this on some psychological kind of websites, that empathy alone isn't necessarily ethical. There can be the kind of empathy that is called dissonant empathy, which is when you empathize intellectually, but then you use your understanding of another person to manipulate or exploit. But real empathy is actually empathy coupled with compassion. It's empathy that is ethical. And when combined with that compassion, that's what's called Anukampa, the name of our actual project and the name of our monastery. Anukampa means the compassion that resonates, or if you like, empathetic compassion, compassion that resonates with the suffering and responds. Yeah? So empathy is the place where we can either feel overwhelmed and really start to kind of get overwhelmed by our own response to somebody else's suffering. And this is what can lead to empathetic distress or empathetic burnout, yeah? But if empathy is focused and guides compassion, if empathy is the starting place for that sense of wishing to care, wishing to help, and that understanding leads to compassion, then it never leads to burnout. It never leads to fatigue. Compassion fatigue is a myth. There's no such thing as compassion fatigue. Compassion is actually an ethical quality that heals and that feels beautiful because it's focused on the end of suffering. So it's in this space, really, that we have some work to do. It's in that point of meeting the suffering, meeting our own sadness, our own grief, empathizing, being attuned, but then adding that wish to be free. This is where sadness meets compassion. This is where sadness can be transformed, not bypassed, but included in our experience and transformed. So empathy guides and informs compassion. It's almost the emotional intelligence of the heart. I know for myself, when I meet people who might say to me, oh, may you be free from suffering. Oh, it sounds really hard for you, but they don't actually get in there with me. It doesn't have a good effect. It doesn't have the same effect as somebody that I know genuinely understands. And there's a lovely example in the Buddhist suttas of a famous bhikkhuni. So that's a fully ordained nun in the Buddha's day called Patachara. And she went through unimaginable grief. In a single day, 24 hours, she lost, first of all, her husband, who was bitten by a snake. He went out to try and find some shelter as she was about to give birth on the road. And then she lost both her children. She gave birth to her youngest child and was carrying both of her children to try and get to her parents' house. And while she was crossing a river, something terrible happened. One of the sons had, I think she'd taken one of them already to one side of the river and she was about to come back for the next. But as she was walking back to the other side of the bank, a vulture came down and picked up the son that she'd left on the ground, carried her off. And she started waving her hands to get rid of that bird. And as she was waving her hands, the other son on the other side, who she'd gone back to pick up, thought she was saying, come in. To the river. So the son walked into the river and drowned. So by now she's beside herself with grief and still trying to make her way to the parents' house. And then she was told that the house had burned down. She saw the smoke on the horizon. There'd been a terrible thunderstorm, maybe lightning, I'm not sure. And her parents and brother also passed away. And she became completely mad. She became completely out of her mind with grief. And through her good karma, through her good fortune, she came across the Buddha and walked into the monastery completely naked, completely out of her mind. And the Buddha said, come. And he threw on a robe like this to cover her body. And from then on, she was called Patachara, which means the one that wears the robe or like the rag robe. And some time being exposed to the Buddha's teachings and obviously desperate for a solution to her anguish, she became fully enlightened through an understanding of impermanence and the impermanent nature of existence and life. And then she became an incredible teacher. And the really interesting thing that I read recently in the suttas is that most of her disciples were women who had also lost their children. And that's why I think she was such a powerful teacher for them, because these were people that hadn't been able to make much progress under anybody else. But when they came in contact with her, not only was she an exceptional teacher, probably owing to the amount of suffering she'd actually been through herself, but also because she genuinely understood where they were at. And she could show them that she'd been through it too, and she had become free. If she could do it, so could they. And this is it, isn't it? It's like when somebody else has been through something we have, it's not necessary to help another person that you've been through their exact experience, and their experience will always be different from yours. But if you have some ability to understand what another person's going through, and a person can feel that, they can really feel that you care, that you're moved, that you're touched, then not only are you more motivated to help, but they know that you care. And they know, they have that confidence that you can guide them because they've been through it themselves. Yeah. I was thinking about getting some coaching for myself recently, and I was thinking, well, where do I go? You know, it's not like I need a therapist necessarily, because I feel pretty resourced in some ways. And yet the role that I'm in, heading up the first monastery for fully ordained women in England, is extremely isolating and challenging, and a lot of the time, very hard work. And it's not that anyone else in this country understands, because no one else is in my situation of being a Sangha member alone. Now I have a trainee, and fortunately you haven't had to like do all the hard yards of going out and teaching when you didn't feel ready and not having anywhere to live and all of this stuff. Now, you know, now I'm in the flow. I'm teaching. Hopefully people get benefit. It's not about me. And I have somewhere to live, so things are easier. But challenges that, you know, it's hard to talk to anyone about. And so actually it was you that suggested, why don't I look for like activist coaches or something like this? Because in a way what we are doing is a kind of activism, right? We're trying to basically give women a fair chance in the face of much discrimination. You know, and that's in Buddhist traditions, in the monastic tradition, the place that we go for refuge, and we experience discrimination there. I know it's not just only women, it's also members of the LGBTQIA plus community, especially trans people, still don't really have the same opportunities to ordain. And we're working on that, you know, but it takes time. And that's something marginalized communities are sick of hearing, right? It takes time, it takes time, and it takes time. And so I realized that that might be a really good idea, to go to people who are also activists and understand the challenges of the role, that it's not personal suffering, it's systemic, and there's no judgment there when we understand these are systems we're dealing with. It's not a personal failure to be tired. It's not a personal failure to struggle more than someone with better support networks, right? When the systems are unequal. And so again, this was an example of an instinct that I think many of us have, that we can better be met by people who understand than people who just want us to be free from suffering, people who've been there themselves, yeah? And so how do we start to develop empathy that can really turn into compassion? And I think the first starting place is with ourselves. It's with getting familiar with our emotional world, learning how to handle our emotions gently, kindly, and with warmth, with respect. So I'm aware that time is running out, but I thought I'll go through a few different ways and leave some time for Q&A. We can discuss the practice a little bit more in the questions. But the first thing is to develop the two kinds of empathy in balance. So there's cognitive empathy, which is a sense of understanding a person's behaviors, maybe why they might behave the way they do, what might motivate them. But it can remain aloof. It can remain intellectual. So secondly, there's emotional empathy, which is where we start to actually resonate with the person's feelings. We tear up. Actually, my dear Simoneri was tearing up the other day because I lost a very dear Dhamma sister, and really like a sister to me. We've been friends since 1998 in India, and I heard, and I didn't know this, I felt almost guilty for not knowing this, that she passed away and had had cancer for the last year or so. And we did a little vigil for her, and I was tearing up, and so were you, and it was so sweet, and I felt really supported by that, actually, and I felt that her whole family would feel supported by that, so I let them know. And it's an example of emotional empathy, which is very beautiful indeed. And so to develop this, we need to start with ourselves, and we start with a sense of embodied awareness. So that's what we did when we arrived here, and in the beginning of the meditation I asked you to get a sense of how your body's feeling and open up to the feelings in your body that are grounded in the present moment, and to let them be, just to let them be, not to try to change them, not to try to fix them up. Have you ever been fixed? Have you ever had your pain minimized? We don't want to do that here. We want to listen in. We want to listen in with an open heart to exactly how we feel. And in a way, this is the beginnings of mindfulness, right? We get curious. We get engaged with what's happening right now. This is mindfulness. And when we give that non-judgmental space to the way that we feel, we can start to relax. You know, it's the judgment that makes us feel tense. It's our own judgment quite often when we meditate. Oh, I'm not sure I should be feeling like this. Other people are sitting still. You know, I've been meditating ages and look at me, I'm still thinking, da, da, da. That's judgment. That's cruelty. That's thoughts of cruelty, not thoughts of compassion. Yeah. So we get on our own side and we stop judging our experience and then we can start to relax. The benefits of this is that we get a clearer sense of our emotional world so that if we are going to engage with another person, and especially if it's a difficult situation, we can stay grounded in our own experience. This helps us develop emotional boundaries, yeah? We need emotional boundaries so that we don't get confused between what are our feelings and what are someone else's. We can feel our feelings in response to someone else, but we're not feeling what they feel. We're feeling what we feel in response. And when you know where your world ends and their world starts, it doesn't create a sense of separation. It creates more respect. It creates more presence and more resilience to stay grounded and to hold the space for them. So one part of our mind is connecting with them, is listening into them. Another part of the mind stays present. And because we have this emotional embodied awareness, we can have balance. Yeah. We can take measures, if you like, to ground ourselves, to relax more deeply before we get into overwhelm. And we can add that sense of self-compassion too. I've been doing this a lot when I've been doing like meditation interviews for people. I just consider my role not to fix them or give them advice. Usually they don't ask for any meditation advice, believe it or not. Meditation interview. Any meditation question? No. But they want to talk. They just want to talk. And so my role, as I see it, is to create a non-judgmental, open, warm-hearted space for them to feel heard. That means I listen. I don't jump in to fix. Yeah. I'm not the fixer here. I'm just the listener. And by listening, people figure it out for themselves. So this is one way that that embodied awareness immediately starts to help. We sense when we're off balance. And we also start to open up to a much more rich emotional world. You know, sometimes we've become kind of numb. We've become afraid to feel. And if we don't feel the painful experiences, guess what? We don't feel the pleasant ones either. We numb down all of our emotional apparatus and we're not as alive to life. So waking up to our feeling world wakens us up to the beautiful qualities like compassion, like inspiration, like peace, like joy, which are very allowable emotions to have. And the Buddha encouraged us to have them and to develop them to their fulfillment. The next thing, once we become emotionally embodied and aware, is to add kindness. And this is what my teacher calls kindfulness. We're changing mindfulness to kindfulness. And if you think this is not from the suttas, you're wrong. Again, going back to the beginning of the talk, the Four Noble Truths are part of right view. The consequence of right view are the three right motivations of which compassion is one. Compassion is the way that we're aware. It's the way that we relate to what we experience, the way we relate to suffering itself. And so mindfulness is never bare. Mindfulness needs to carry the qualities of kindness and compassion with it. And it soothes. It soothes us as it flows through our bodies and minds. So we add this kindness to the way we're aware. And we carry this beautiful sense of warmth throughout our bodies and minds. We can experiment with this. You know, it's not easy to describe it. But if you kind of think of it as picking up a pair of lenses, and maybe for me, compassion is like a deep gold, like the colour in that room, actually, like a sort of old gold, like a really rich yellow or close to orange colour for me. So I imagine like seeing the world through that lens. It might be a colour, it might be a feeling like softness or warmth, but however it works for you. And it has a feeling, it has an effect, it tends to soften our emotional world and sometimes our physical body. Sometimes it actually starts to heal the pains, the aches, and maybe even disease that we're carrying in our body. And for me, with the friend who passed away, it definitely helped. I was able to be aware of my feelings of grief and shock and open up to them. And I found myself walking about the day quite a little bit fumbly. Normally I'd be like, oh, come on, hurry up, get your act together. But I was gentle with myself. I allow myself to kind of fumble around and just be kind of vulnerable in a way. I felt very safe. I had my lovely Simoneri with me and we made it a soothing day. But then when we did do the vigil and remembered her and I spoke to her through my heart, you know, verbally, I kind of spoke to her and said the things I wish I could have said, what she meant to me and how I hope her journey will continue on to freedom and to peace. I felt the tears coming, but I also felt this sense of warmth and compassion and that enabled me to reach out to her family and offer support. So adding that compassion means that we connect. We connect to ourselves, we include our emotions, but also we're able to feel resourced enough to meet other people's suffering as well and actually offer support. Does this make sense? I hope I'm making sense. Yeah? Good. And then, lastly, the wisdom of change. So these are practical things, right? So first, embodied awareness, letting things be, non-judgmental. Second, healthy relationship, adding compassion, adding warmth. And then the wisdom of change. Now, the thing about mindfulness is that when it's bare, we think it's bare, but it might carry with it, it usually carries with it, our old conditioned patterns. So we might think we're being aware of something unpleasant, but actually we're resisting it. We're kind of a little bit at a distance from it. When we add kindness, we're able to stay with it. When you're kind to something, it's easier to be with. When someone's kind to you, you want to be around them, right? So when we're kind to our experience, it tends to stay. And because it tends to stay, we can stay with it, we can be present to it, even if it's difficult, it starts to open up. It starts to reveal its nature to us. And we start to see things change. We start to see the feelings rise and pass away. We start to see the thoughts coming and going, entering into our mind, maybe being loud in the beginning and then quietening down, or we see the thought pattern slowly change. We start to get connected to the deeper realities of what it means to have this body and mind, the realities of the Dhamma, impermanence, and also non-self, because whatever is impermanent cannot belong to us. If it belong all the time, but when going, coming and going, how can we say that they're mine? The Buddha said again and again, you know, things are arising and passing. Can that be a self? And the monks and the nuns would say, no, venerable sir, it's not me, not mine, not a self. Is what is impermanent and not self happiness or suffering? It's suffering. It's suffering, arising and passing away. And again, the only response, we start to see this wisdom of change. We start to see change and wisdom arises and we are more able to allow experience to flow through. We don't cling to the unpleasant or pleasant. Sometimes we cling to the unpleasant, right? If we cling to the pleasant, guess what? It becomes unpleasant. So we don't allow this aversion or craving to arise, because when something's arising and passing so quickly, after a while your mind gets really attuned to the speed of this change and it's changing all the time. What can you hold on to? It's like sand passing through your fingers. It's just falling away, or like sandbanks. I guess it must be amazing to be like in the Sahara and see all the like, what do you call them? All the sand dunes just changing with the wind. This is our impermanence. We think something's solid. We think it's always been there, but the whole thing can just shift. sometimes in an instant. And so we are able to find peace in that change. And this is the place where wisdom actually starts to develop peace. And from that peace, we can develop even deeper compassion. So compassion develops wisdom, but wisdom enables a path of peace to open and the path to these deep states of meditation to be wide open to us. So the Buddha said that there's no deep samadhi without wisdom, and there's no wisdom without deep samadhi. So these things start to work together. And from here, when we have that familiarity and wisdom in how to handle our inner world, we can actually start to cultivate compassion in a deeper kind of way. We can actually start to cultivate compassion as a path to the deep meditation without bypassing anything. Does that make sense? So this is where compassion can be used as a brahmavihara. We can start to repeat the words of compassion, perhaps starting with ourselves or starting with a loved one, and then start to spread it out to all directions and until it pervades the whole of our bodies and minds, until it pervades the whole universe. And that separation between self and other starts to dissolve. And that's why it's called a brahmavihara. There is no separation. It's simply a state of mind. It's a beautiful state. It's a wholesome state, and it's to be cultivated. And the more we cultivate this, the more it becomes our inclination in life, the more it becomes our character, and we'll find that our lives have more meaning. We find much more joy in service. We find we're able to face challenging situations, even move into challenging situations, and truly be of benefit to the world. So this is what I would like to offer today on the theme of compassion and the role of sadness, grief, and all kinds of emotions when we meet them with that compassion to transform the mind and heart. So I hope this has been of benefit to everybody here. Okay. So now it is time for some questions, if you wish. And is that okay?
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
Okay. So any questions, comments, or complaints? Ajahn Brahm has the three Qs, the three Cs, he calls it, the three Cs. Question, spelled C-W, I guess. Comments, complaints.
It's Australian, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, actually, he's British, but anyway, whatever. We'll allow him both. And I've added one, compliments. I'm just kidding. Yeah. So anything didn't make sense? Yes.
I was interested that you said compassion fatigue is a myth.
Uh-huh.
I think it isn't.
Yeah.
In some way. We can get exhausted.
Yeah.
Have fatigue.
Yeah.
We're just overwhelmed.
Absolutely.
Trying to feel compassion for there's so much terrible suffering going on.
Yeah.
How can you explain that?
Okay, super. Great question. So, can people online hear the question, or do you want me to? You could. Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so maybe for the recording, the question is, this person thought there was such a thing as compassion fatigue. I said there wasn't. How is that the case when we can get so exhausted and fatigued from experiencing and, you know, trying to develop compassion for the suffering in the world? And I think perhaps it depends on the translation of the word compassion to some extent. Maybe the idea of compassion in the West is slightly different from the Buddhist understanding, because the word compassion apparently means com with passion, suffering. So it literally means with suffering, being with suffering. I would say that's closer to what I would call empathy. And the differentiation that's being made nowadays by psychologists is that what we call compassion fatigue is actually empathy fatigue. So it's not that it's not a part of the whole picture, But I think it arises because the focus on suffering is predominant rather than the focus on freedom from suffering. So the way the Buddha described compassion is focusing on freedom from suffering. Having already contacted it, so that's the empathy part, but then from that understanding, allowing it to develop into a wish for beings' freedom from suffering and the active effort to alleviate that suffering. I think it's in the effort itself and it's in the rejoicing in that effort, the getting in touch with that really pure intention that restores and keeps the mind resilient. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tricky one. I think the other reason it sometimes goes wrong is, like I said in the talk, sometimes the compassion is more externalized and we forget to have the same amount of compassion for ourselves. So we don't actually stop in time. We continue to kind of engage with suffering beyond a point that it's helpful to us. So we allow ourselves to, I mean, sometimes we can't avoid it. Pay some of that in life because we can't always from a situation. But I think if we can notice that we're actually starting to move into empathetic distress and we can take measures to direct that compassion to ourselves at that moment, then that can also help it to stop escalating. I mean, I've done that myself. I've had burnouts and, you know, because I've just been serving, and I haven't been going to bed early enough. I haven't been doing enough meditation. You know, I've been putting all my energy out there. And I think that's one thing that's so important to remember. We treat ourselves not with enough gentleness.
Mm.
Yeah.
Can I ask, what benefit do you think it's fair to say if you pick up a lot of energy, empathy, to not to be aware of not exposing yourself to wide a range of protecting yourself within what you were saying with yourself, how much you expose yourself to.
Right,
rather than going a whole lot.
Absolutely.
Like what you were saying then.
Yeah. So the question on how much we expose ourselves to it or how much we're exposed to, and I think that's where wisdom comes into play. You know, recognizing, are we now indulging in the causes of suffering or are we focused on the freedom again? Are we actually practicing the way out? And if there's so much suffering that it's just impossible, our compassion can't meet that level of suffering, it's not developed enough to, then we're exposing ourselves to. So absolutely, it's if we can take a step back, we should. And I think that often for most of us here is probably what we consume to a large extent, the amount of news we consume, the kind of people that we hang out with as well. You know, if you're around people who are constantly negative.
Or draining us.
Then we're going to get exhausted. So we have to have that sort of respect for our own capacity. I mean, it grows in time. And I think we have to be really respectful of our own capacity for compassion in any given moment, because that's not fixed either, right? It changes depending on if we're tired or if we also have a lot of stuff going on in our personal life, or even the climate, the season, all those kind of things. What we've eaten can affect it. So many things. Hormones can affect it, especially if you're perimenopausal. It can really affect the amount of compassion that you can bring forth, you know, and you need a lot more for yourself. So to really respect ourselves and to allow this compassion to grow gradually is an important thing. And, you know, again, it's part of not judging, isn't it? Because we can look at the world and think, wow, there's so much to do. What is my little donation going to do? What difference can it make? What is just wishing this person, you know, saying, oh, I'm so sorry for your loss. How is that going to help? But it helps. It really helps. I noticed with my own friend, you know, just reaching out and putting a tribute on my page, for example, meant a lot to the family because they can read the love that she received and also the effect that her life had on people, the incredible things that she did. And that is healing for them. So we can do something. We can't do everything. Was it Mother Teresa who said, we're not asked to do great things. We're asked to do small things with great love. I think that's just so wonderful. Yeah. I'm just checking the chat on here to see if there's any questions. Okay, I'll come to a question on Zoom. I was deeply disturbed recently to see a close relative delighting in cruel speech. They feel they're morally correct because they're only cruel to or about those they perceive as bad people. Any advice on how to encourage them to develop more compassion for those they disagree with and dislike? Yeah, that's a super duper question. And I had meant to include a little bit about compassion to the perpetrators of harm, which are probably the people that this person is talking cruelly about. I mean, at least in their mind, this person's doing things that are wrong, and so their speech is becoming cruel. And, you know, it's easy to understand how our minds can move in that direction when we see other people harming beings, especially if they're in positions of power and they're harming a lot of beings, right? Then it can be the case that our thoughts become cruel. And I think for me, one really important practice is to remember that, as the Buddha said, people who are creating harm for others are actually sick. They're actually deranged, if you like. They've kind of lost the plot, right? The Buddha said that somebody who has no compassion for others is like a person who's gravely sick and who is a long way from the village, who doesn't have food, who doesn't have medicine, who doesn't have an attendant, who doesn't have a doctor. The food, the medicine, the attendant are kind of similes for the Dhamma, the Sangha, the attendant, and the Buddha, the doctor. They're far away from these things. And he says one should arouse sheer compassion and tender concern for such people. So for me, I think it's about recognizing that in order to create suffering for another, one has to be suffering oneself. It's impossible to create suffering and to be cruel when you're happy, when you're peaceful. So to point out that anybody we see in this world behaving in those ways, whether, you know, perpetuating racism or bullying people or whatever they might be doing, misusing power, sexual abuse, etc., just being generally cruel and unkind, that person is really not at peace. That person is far away from the Dhamma, and to arouse compassion within our hearts. So that's one thing you could do. The other thing you could do, if you can, I mean, of course, only expose yourself to it as long as it's tolerable, and if you can, remove yourself from the situation. But if possible, you can try to empathize with them, even if they're being cruel, and say, try and get behind the speech and say, well, I see that you must be really distressed. Is that how you feel, you know? Where do you feel that, you know? How does that manifest for you? Like, what does it bring? What else does it bring up? You can actually indulge them to some extent, but not on the content of the speech, on what's behind it. So don't engage with the speech, but engage with the person's pain, if that makes sense. Yeah. Does that make sense? Anyone else here? Yeah.
So I'm really quite interested in what you said tonight. It's quite amazing. And the question will occur.
Yeah, sure. It doesn't have to be a question. Yeah, it doesn't have to be.
I'm interested in the journey of this, because for me, I came across contemplation 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've become a lot more aware of the things that you've been talking about tonight. I think sometimes the awareness has caused me quite a lot of difficulty, because the things that were working in my life before aren't working anymore.
Yeah.
But quite a number of the people around me, including family, are still in that space.
Yeah.
And I just, yeah, so...
Yeah.
I can sort of really, I'm excited. I mean, the thing that excited me by your post, it was 3 to 4 months of silence. That just excites me, but I don't think it excited me 15 years ago. And
yeah.
I think that that is just a completely crazy idea. So it can feel quite... It can feel quite lonely sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the beautiful... Did people hear that? Kind of. It's about when we become more aware, like this person started practicing about 10 years ago and became a lot more aware of what was going on for him. And that awareness wasn't always easy because people around didn't necessarily understand, nor were living in a similar way. So sometimes it felt quite lonely. Is that okay, yeah, as a nutshell? And the thing that he was attracted to by this evening's talk was the fact that I mentioned spending 3 or 4 months in silence every year, and that wouldn't have normally attracted him, but it does nowadays, and probably wouldn't attract your family, I guess, either. Or most people, actually. I don't know. And it sounds attractive. Sometimes it's challenging. But, yeah, it's great that you've brought that up. It's exactly the right place to bring it up, and I think that's how we can feel less alone, you know, the fact that we're in a room where other people will have had and will be having that experience, and that's precisely why we all come together in a place like this,
yeah,
so that we can talk about this and we don't feel weird. We feel kind of, yeah, validated in that experience. And that's another aspect of empathy, you know, normalizing emotions and validating people's experience. And I think it's a good sign. It's a difficult experience when you're going through that process, but it's actually a sign that you're starting to wake up and, you know, your values are starting to change a little bit. But I mean, what can happen in the beginning is we tend to judge other people. We think, oh, these people, they're still like that. I'm so not like that. But after a while, if we can just stay with our own values without having to necessarily preach, we can just continue to cultivate them. People will start to take you as a kind of example, as a good example, because they'll see that you're changing and they'll be attracted to the path, even if they're not, but you'll be having an influence on them somehow.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to also have your own support and make your own, you know, create your own community. I think that's part of what compassion for ourselves can do. You know, we realize we need each other, we need community, we need our own support networks outside of our old circle of family and friends. So, yeah, I really wish you well with that.
And
I think it's marvelous that you're getting, you know, drawn and attracted to the idea of long retreat. That's fantastic. Yeah.
I've done sort of 3 to 4 day.
Yeah.
Silent retreat.
Great.
Monasteries.
Yeah, super.
So I've, you know, I thought I would find that difficult. I've found it difficult in some ways.
Yeah.
But, I mean, my daughter picked me up from Northampton train station when I came back, and by the time I got back to Kettering, and she asked me if I was okay because I hadn't spoken all the
way. Oh, yes.
It had just done something to me.
Oh, yeah. That's so lovely. So just bring that up whenever you feel lonely or, you know, just bring up the benefits you're getting and just try and rejoice in that. Yeah, that's really beautiful. Well, we organise retreats too, so I hope that you get more opportunities to be on retreat. It's great that you live here and you're not far from the temples around here. So, yeah, that's really great.
And if I may add, we meet every Monday here.
Yeah.
You meet every Monday. Yeah. It's really important. Right. And I would like to just plug what you're trying to do here by saying that, you know, meetings in person are getting more and more rare. It's really lovely to have people attend on Zoom. I love it because often the people who come are in different countries or they have like, what do you call it, accessibility issues, whether it's because of their own physical limitations or, you know, diseases and age, or whether it's just expensive and far to travel. Nothing can really replace in-person experiences. And I know that you need enough people to be able to give enough donation to hire the place. So if people don't come, then you won't be having these meetings anymore. And I think this is a lovely group. you know, you're very kind of open-minded towards different types of Buddhism and obviously very sincere practitioners involved in beautiful social work and, you know, really good livelihood. So, yeah, that's why I come all this way. It's a long way to come. Mm-hmm. And it's a small group. I mean, you know, I could teach to more people, but I feel this is really important because you're a little bit out of the way. So, yeah, keep coming to this place. And, you know, you can create community. You don't have to only find existing community. You can create it yourself. That's what we're trying to do too. So, yeah. Okay, there's another comment here. We've only got a couple more minutes, so is that right? At 9 o'clock we have to end?
No, I don't have to, but yes.
Okay, out of compassion for our driver, fine, put down. Perhaps. Okay, all right. I recently had someone close to me say some really unkind, judgmental things and how people don't like the way I act. They said these things in anger, and despite having been told the opposite by most of the people, it has really hurt me and led to a lot of self-doubt. Any advice on taking these things less personally? I think somehow having more compassion, unsure how, more self-compassion. Any help or tips are much appreciated. Thank you. There was one little a teaching from the Buddha. Sometimes just reading them is nice. And he gave it, I think, to Rahula. And it was about receiving criticism. He said, you know, the earth receives all this crap, basically. People throw things on the earth, they spit on the earth, they poo on the earth, they urinate on the earth. Does the earth ever complain? The earth never complains. And also, those things that you throw on the earth don't really have much effect. And he said, be like the earth, Rahula. He was speaking to his son, be like the earth. And then the same thing for the air. You know, people put all sorts of stuff into the air. Da, 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 da. The earth, does it ever complain? Be like the air. Be like the fire. It burns up everything. So sometimes just reflecting in this way can help. But the way I also take those similes is that the earth is vast. The earth is huge. And in the same way, we can make our minds vast and huge. And that's how practices like compassion, like metta, can increase our capacity to withstand pain. It's like if we are cultivating wholesome states, essentially we're cultivating happiness in our mind, right? Compassion is supposed to lead to happiness. Genuine compassion is a beautiful state of mind, quite a profound state of happiness because of its connection to suffering. And so when we develop that a lot before this happens, when people throw this stuff at us, we have a bigger container. And also the mind of compassion is a soft mind, which means it's kind of bouncy. So people can throw stuff and it just bounces off. You know, it's not brittle. Small minds, hard minds, which are tired or which are angry, they're very brittle. One more thing and you blow up, right? But if you've got a really big, resourced, soft, resilient mind, then somebody says something and, yeah, it doesn't tend to stick. So, I mean, nobody likes this happening. Don't worry, because it's quite normal for it to hurt you. But I don't know if it helps. I'll be one of the people who says, hey, Sean, you're really a very kind and giving person. You've got a wonderful family. We got your card. And it was signed by Filippo as well, your little boy. And honestly, it's those people's problem. When people say things to us that are unkind, it's usually because they're hurting. And as Ajahn Brahm likes to say, it says more about them than about you. So, yeah. Believe the majority and believe the non. Should you believe the monks and the nuns? You can believe me if you wish.
Can I ask something?
Yes. Please.
In the food position, I went on a performance course with somebody. One thing he said, which stuck in my mind, and I said, criticism is frequently false and often malicious.
Yeah.
Praise is nearly always genuine.
Oh. Okay, I'll try and repeat that for the sake of the Zoom. Criticism is frequently false and often malicious. Praise
is
nearly always genuine. Criticism is usually false and often malicious. Praise is nearly always genuine. that's really nice. And that's, as a folk musician, someone said that to you.
He's a musician himself.
Oh.
He's actually a performance coach.
Yeah, a performance coach said this. Yeah.
Thinking about it now, had contact with him, it wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't Lewis.
If he was...
If he wasn't, I'd be surprised if he wasn't a Buddhist.
Right, yeah.
Just thinking about it now.
Yeah, he was probably a Buddhist, yeah. You know, the other thing I'd say is that often, it's really weird, but you can see this on social media sometimes, it's often when you stand out, even when you're trying to do good, or you're becoming successful, that people think they should criticise you. Sometimes just because you're visible, actually. Like, because you're visible, you get a lot of focus on you. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of, for musicians, you're on a stage, you know, maybe it happens. For me, in my role, it happens because it's easy to target blame. And it's often people that themselves haven't tried to do those things, but they want to criticise you for not doing it right. I saw something on Facebook. It was a beautiful quote by Arundhati Roy. She's an Indian author and a bit of a social activist, actually. And she was saying some very profound things and kind of calling out misogyny and other harmful behaviours, but in a very skillful way, not blaming anyone, but just kind of talking about patterns and systems. And somebody said, yeah, she can say this, but what's she doing? And I just thought, well, she's saying it. You know, that's her act of compassion. What are you doing? Just criticising her. So sometimes you can see it as a good thing, actually. I mean, we don't want it. We don't like criticism. But honestly, the more public you are, the more successful you are, the more of both you're going to receive. So it's kind of up to you which one you listen to. I get it too. And unfortunately, the mind has something called a negativity bias. So it's like, what do they say? It's like Velcro for the bad stuff and like a sieve for the good stuff. So that's why we have to say these things to ourselves again and again. We can praise ourselves. We can encourage ourselves through our own practice, through reciting beautiful phrases of loving kindness and self-care. And then that is, you know, a positive conditioning on your mind. You need to say it 10 times more often than the negative. It's about right, actually. I think they said, criticism goes in within 2 seconds. Praise takes about 20 to 30 seconds. So you have to keep it going until it starts to sink in. Yeah.
Because there's no evolutionary advantage to...
Yes. There's no evolutionary advantage to praise, this person say.
And criticism around... You know, that would could potentially signal negative danger, things like that.
Yes.
There's an evolutionary advantage to that.
Exactly. So criticism could signal genuine danger.
Praise wouldn't.
And praise wouldn't, yeah. And we still kind of think our lives are in danger when we receive criticism. That's why it really has an impact. So be kind to yourself as well. One book I have actually is called, what's it called? Maybe Just Compassion by Paul Gilbert? And he's a neuroscientist. It's a great book. And he says that because this is the way our brains are wired, like they've evolved this way, we have to be so compassionate to ourselves. It's actually our brains are wired this way. You're not going to change it overnight. So, you know, this is natural. It's just that we're kind of trying to do something quite radical. It's almost like we're trying to change the wiring, actually, and the evolution and evolve our brains. Yeah. Okay. Someone said it's called a tall poppy syndrome, getting cut as you grow tall. Yeah, thank you. The Compassionate Mind by Paul Gilbert. Yeah, that's got so many exercises to develop compassion. Right, it's just after 9. There's one more question here, and then I'm going to leave the questions on Zoom and come back to the room because I want to make sure everyone gets their comment responded to. Lastly, from Zoom, this is all helping me understand how to deal with a sick relative who sometimes resents my help. Sometimes I question, am I actually helping or is it the illness? Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. I think if we're not sure it's actually helping, we could consider that it's the illness. Sometimes we might want to experiment by just backing off a little bit. But I think the most important thing is to help in a genuine way whereby you get happiness from simply the intention to help, so that even if it's not received well, you still try your best. So giving without expecting anything in return. Okay, we're going to start wrapping up. I think Minori might put some comment in the chat about how to keep in contact with us. And I'm coming back to the room one more time to see if there are any last comments to be made for the evening before we close. Anything else anyone want to say or to share? Okay.
If I may conclude.
Yes, please. Yes.
Divide. Of course, thank you so much. You found time in a tremendously busy schedule, including your retreats, your prolonged selfish retreats. That's a joke. And I think people have been touched. I can hear from the comments they've been touched by the teaching, but also, Venerable Chanda, by your honesty, your openness in bringing in your own examples and where you find that emotional strength that is there, with or without a, what was the term?
Oh, coaching activist coach.
As you know, it is there, that resilience, but maybe needs cranking up, I don't know.
Oh, no, it's good. Yeah, it's good. It just doesn't always feel easy, right? But that's not what life's supposed to be. Yep. I decided a while ago that I'm not after an easy life.
No.
I'm after a meaningful life. Yeah. So I actually prefer it to be difficult and meaningful than easy and...
You could have got a job in Swindon working for the civil service. Wow.
Could have been on the local council. Taking down those flags. Anyway,
thank you so much, and we really appreciate it. We hope we can see you again. We certainly should make the trek over to Oxford, which
that is would be far great. Away.
And we thank Andrew very much for bringing you here,
yes,
taking you back, and then making his way back home.
Absolutely,
before thank you so much. Thank you.